The following is intended for mature audiences only. Discretion is advised.
Thank you so much for downloading this episode of So What Do You Really Do? The podcast where I, your host, Deader Dennis Maller, talks to artists and entertainers about their day jobs. And the artist and entertainer on the podcast today is Ash Paulson, who is a video game journalist, a YouTuber, I guess fair to say blogger as well. He's a writer of video game reviews and video game culture. And before we get to it, I just want to say, I am over 150 80 plus minute tours into my duck boat duck tour season, and this is how the voice is sounding. Not great, but not as bad as last year. I think we're going to hold on to it this year. We're going to see. I mean, we're going to be going into, it's the end of May, so this is exactly when I started last year, and I was already a little bit straining, and then it just went downhill from there. So we'll see how the rest of the season goes. I would say at 155 right now at the end of June is a little under expected, but we got Memorial Day weekend coming up, so I feel like by the end of May I will be into June. I feel like we'll hit 200. It's not a goal, but I do expect to probably hit 600 tours this year. Last year, my first season, I did 440 80 minute tours of Boston, 80 plus minutes, because sometimes there's traffic. But this year, I think, you know, starting a whole full season, it's very easy for me to 600 because I like to work. I like to do my job. I like going out there. I like staying late. I like making that money. I have fun doing these things. I have friends who do 800 tours a year and they are insane, and 700 plus tours a year. And I have no interest in that. If I don't hit 600, it is not a disappointment. It is not a goal. It's an expectation of what the season is going to be and how much I'm going to work. Although the season has been slow for the beginning, but we'll see how the rest of it turns out. But I am having as much fun as I did last year, if not more. And I'm looking forward to having a whole nother season of entertaining tourists here in Boston with my wit and humor about history. So that's where we're at right now with things. I will say this, sorry about the clearing of the throat. Now that the intros and the videos are video, I can't cut those things out because there's weird jump cuts and I don't like that. But anyway, these are straight through. Yay, one takes, or I'll do multiple takes. I'm only 2-3 minutes in. I can change it if I want to, but I'm not going to. This is authenticity, no editing. All right. Enough about that. Don't get me started on other podcasters and their what they think qualifies them as being authentic. It ain't lack of editing. All right. Don't go on rants. Don't go on rants, Dennis. Keep your calm. My goals for this year is to be less upset about things. We'll see how that works out. I've been playing the ukulele out in public in front of people. And it's been here's the weird thing. I may have talked about this on the other podcast episodes, I'm not even sure, but I have talked to this about people, is I don't, as a performer, someone who's performed their entire life, as someone, as Kevin Pollak calls it, was born with the "hey, look at me" gene. To be nervous in public in front of people is an unusual space for me, and that's where playing the ukulele is. And then you're going to go, but Dennis, don't you play the ukulele in front of people on tour all day long? Yes, but there's no expectations of being good there. The funnier it is, the worse I am as a, the worse I am, the funnier the entire tour is. So I don't try. I don't have any nerves about that. But if you want me to play, you know, Good Riddance by Green Day in front of people, my hands become jelly and my heart rate goes to 135 beats per minute. So, as someone who wants to grow and challenge himself and become a better musician, not for any other reason other than my own enjoyment of a hobby. This is a hobby. I don't need to monetize everything in my life. I want to get better at this hobby. And so with that comes playing in front of people. So I've been going to open mics for the past few months and playing in front of people very quietly. And I'm getting better at it. I had some expectations last night of playing a new song, and it went terrible, but that's okay, because I tried, and I just got to keep chugging along and keep trying. So there it is, and I'm having fun hanging out with the musicians at open mics as opposed to hanging out with comedians at open mics. It's a different world. I have friends at these music open mics already, so it's like, it's not, I'm not in a strange world. I'm a strange man in a strange world. Oh, who are these strangers? Strange. People are strange when you're a stranger, when you're alone. Okay. The voice, though, the singing's not helping it. And trust me, doing the tours is not helping the singing. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect at everything. I need to be better, but don't need to be perfect. Anyway. I'm enjoying that space. So there's enough about me. Let's talk about our podcast guest, because this is going to be a fun one. Ash Paulson and I are pandemic friends. Oh, I know you're going to, you knew it was coming. We met during the pandemic. I was helping to produce and show run him and his father's Flappers Comedy Zoom show, Game That Tune, where the two of them bring in voiceover artists who also do work in the video game realm. And they interview them and they let open up a Q&A for all their fans to be able to talk to them. And it was great working with Ash and his father, Rob. They're super nice people. I've made mention of it plenty of times, and it'll be mentioned in this conversation of some of the people I work with at Flappers. Didn't know my name. They just, hey, Flappers guy. The first time openly, just in conversation, like, connecting to the Zoom, and Rob looking at me going, oh, hey, what's up, Dennis? Instead of, hey, what's going on, Dennis? Or, hey, what's going on? What was your name again? Dennis, that's right. Just look at me and go, hey, Dennis, good seeing you again. Was like, oh, you know. And, you know, getting emails from Ash going, hey, we're going to do this on the show tomorrow. Can you handle that? Can you make this video work? Or can you play this? And just dealing with them was super nice and great. And they have some amazing, appreciative, loving fans. And it was a great positive experience working with them and helping them create their vision and helping to work with the people that adore these voiceover artists that are coming on the show to talk about their careers. And it was also nice being the bad guy for them, where it's like, oh, all right, that's the end of the show, everybody. We can't take any more questions. We ran out of time. Good night. And being the one to have to say, hey, everybody, back off. It show's over. You know, being that guy was a little bit fun because they're getting mad at me. I don't care. But they were not bad people. They were wonderful people. I wish that if you're listening to the podcast and you're one of the Game That Tune fans, you guys are wonderful. Thank you so much for being a part of that show and making it an delightful enjoyment and a bright shining ray of hope and enjoyment through the pandemic. Thank you guys for being a part of this podcast episode. Thank you for following Ash and coming over here to listen to Ash tell his story of how he got into game journalism. And I will say this, while I was editing this, I realized that I kept using the word game journalism when sometimes I probably should have said gaming content or gaming media and stuff like that. So sometimes you replace that word in your head when you hear me say it. That maybe made some of the conversation and questions make more sense when I was asking them to Asher, to Ash rather. By the way, I don't know anything about video games. I'm fascinated by it. I love that people love video games. It's not for me. I wish I was a gamer. I just don't have that kind of patience. So, or money. Or you know, the desire to sit. You know, I don't sit much when I'm at home. Well, okay, I sit when I work, but I'm doing things usually. I don't do much brain shutting off. Although I think I need some more brain shutting off. So maybe I'll get into video games. We'll see what's on store for me. So I feel like if I'm sitting around too much, if I do too much sitting, the depression creeps in. So, and this podcast is a lot about mental health. For me, talking about or asking people about theirs. And I feel like Ash has a good handle on his mental health when we talk about his childhood and some of the things that he went through and his journey from young boy with a Nintendo NES to a respected video game journalist. So please enjoy my conversation with writer and gamer and YouTuber Ash Paulson. So, by the way, let's talk about, was this your second or third time at PAX?
Oh, God, it was like my 10th or something.
10th? I don't know. See, we yeah. only know each other for a short period of time. So
I don't even know how many times I've been at this point, but probably at least 10.
Okay. All right. Well, how was PAX East this year?
It was excellent. It's always fun. I love both PAX East and West. They both are such fun shows to be a part of. They each have their different vibes because, of course, Boston and Seattle are very different cities, but they're both beautiful in their own way. And you just get different vibes for each, even though they're equally awesome.
Well, describe for those who are listening to podcasts and don't know what, describe what PAX is.
So PAX is essentially a gaming convention, and that means all kinds of games, video games, like console games, PC games, card games, tabletop games, Dungeons and Dragons. It's everything. I would say it's primarily known for video games, like console and PC games, but they cover everything. And that's what I primarily go there for. I work in games myself, primarily console games. And so I go to check out all the latest and greatest stuff. I would say in more recent years, they focus more on indie games, which is great because I love indie games. And, you know, the big AAA studios already have other ways to get in front of players. And this is really a way for indie studios to show their latest and greatest wares, their upcoming games for the next couple of years. And so for me, it's a great way just to discover new indie games that I might not have otherwise heard about, play some new indie demos of games I'm looking forward to already, meeting some friends in the industry who work at various indie devs and such. So it's just a great, it's a great place to meet new people who love games the way you do, discover games you may have never even heard of if you're only looking at the big AAA studios, and a great place to reconnect with friends in the industry whom I only see once or twice a year.
See, now for me, I went to PAX East a couple years ago because a buddy of mine from Baltimore came up and he was hired to do the lighting for a band performance that was performing at the convention center here in Boston. Mm-hmm. So he skipped away. We had lunch. He's like, hey, why don't you come in through the loading dock entrance?
We didn't
check our badges. So
nice.
Come with me and see if you can get in and hang out at PAX. And I was like, done deal, because I've been to a lot of conventions and have only paid to get into one convention. That's
nice.
Quite the mark that I'm holding out. Usually it's press passes or like free passes when I worked in radio stations. Now that I'm an independent podcaster, they don't care about me anymore.
that's same with me. PAX, I don't usually pay to go to because I go as a media or content creator.
So it's other
conventions I do.
It's very different as someone who goes to comic book conventions and then who went to a gaming convention. I'm not a gamer. I love Dungeons and Dragons and role-playing games growing up as a kid. I would love to play them more if I had adult friends who wanted to let me join in their campaigns. Well, I was never into video games. Like the last video game unit we owned was growing up was the original Green Death Game Boy.
Nice.
You know, that weighed like 18 pounds, took 26 AA batteries. You needed a harness and a magnifying glass.
Yep. I just replayed the original Super Mario Land yesterday because they re-released it on Nintendo Switch through the Game Boy emulation platform they have on there. So I was like kind of actually reliving some of my old Game Boy launch glory days yesterday.
See, that's all right. So we'll get to Switch and the old school games, but it's like it was interesting going over on the floor and just watching the entire floor full of people playing games.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm used to watching, it's commerce to me. When I go to a comic book convention, it is, you know, you have Artist Alley where people are selling their wares and signing autographs. Then you got the celebrity section where they're just signing autographs. Mm-hmm. And then you have the entire biggest section of the whole section is sales, is people just selling T-shirts, comic books, stuffed animals. And I've watched the progression over the years. You know, I started going to comic book conventions in the early 2000s, covering them for radio stations, but mostly covering for my own YouTube channel. And occasionally the radio station I work for is like, all right, I guess we'll tweet it. I don't know what we'll do with this content because radio couldn't figure out what content was. But I watched the progressive, like going to these conventions and it's all photographs. You know, I'm one of the few people there taking video because I had the ability to do video. And I watched cosplay go from posing for photos to now being motion because everyone's taking video with their phones and everything like that.
Definitely.
So that's the only thing that I can truly say has changed over the years with conventions in my experience. For you, someone who goes to the gaming conventions for quite some time and someone who's been in gaming for your entire life. And I'm sure before you were a journalist in it, you were going to these conventions or other versions of other things. What is, over the time have you seen change at conventions? You know, the biggest thing is obviously attendance for me, and like I said, the switch from photographs to videos. But for you as a gamer, what's the biggest difference in gaming conventions over the past 10 or plus years?
Well, I mean, I guess with respect, really the main ones that I go to every year or have gone to are both PAXs, PAX West and PAX East, and then until recently, E3. But as you may already know, E3 is gone. It's dead, and there is no more E3. So, and that used to be the big gaming trade show of the year that was more focused on industry professionals, not open to the public, more for, you know, people to, you know, the big studios to show off their slate of games for the coming year or two. And that was something that was closed only to, you know, industry professionals, media, content creators, stuff like that. And there is no more E3 now. So really, that's been a huge change, is that there is no more business-focused gaming trade show anymore. It's kind of been replaced by something called Summer Game Fest, which is happening in L.A. next month, which I'll be attending. And that also is kind of closed only to industry professionals, but it's a lot smaller than E3 was. So definitely one of the biggest changes is just the death of E3 and there being no more E3 like there used to be for so many years. But in terms of PAX, I would say one of the big changes is attendance, for sure. It's just getting bigger and bigger and bigger every year. And so where it used to be, it never, when I started going, it never felt quaint. It never felt small, but it definitely was not on the same scale as it is now with the attendee and the attendance numbers being what they are. And also the big shift I've seen with respect to PAX specifically is a shift from focusing on the big AAA developers like Nintendo, PlayStation, Xbox, you know, Capcom, Square Enix, to, as I said before, really putting the spotlight on indie devs. That doesn't mean that those bigger developers don't have a presence at PAX today. They do, but really PAX, I would say, goes out of its way to really put the spotlight on indie studios, smaller developers, and, you know, get their wares out in front of people.
That's interesting because my experience with E3 is just watching the coverage from G4, which, again, as not a gamer, I watched a ton of G4 growing up because it gave me like old school MTV early 80s vibes where it's like, we're just here doing this. We don't know if anyone's watching. We're testing the waters and we're going out there into crazy land. And I loved Attack of the Show. That was the main thing I watched. I mean, Game or X-Play, I think it was the name of the video game review show with Morgan Webb and Sessler. Yeah. I didn't watch much of that, but I watched it a little bit. But it was mostly all about Attack of the Show, just that world of news. And it's crazy how advanced those shows were, talking about the internet when we barely had an internet. And now those shows would be so much more ingrained in our everyday society now with the explosion of social media and all those shows and stuff like that. So it's like, I feel like there was too many things ahead of its time involved with gaming and comic book conventions that unfortunately gone to the wayside, like G4's live coverage of Comic-Con San Diego. You know, they were going there doing live streaming from San Diego Comic-Con when nobody else was doing live streaming. Them and MTV were the only two, MTV Geek were the only two that were doing that. And now they're both defunct when these things are the biggest events of the year now. Like the people who help make them the biggest events of the year no longer are around anymore.
Well, that's because there are now, I mean, people like, sad to say, we're not me and my team. I mean, it's more about individual content creators and individual content creator teams now. So Twitch streamers, YouTube creators, which is what I am and my team are. So, you know, instead of it being people like G4 and such, now it's YouTube channels like mine, Good Vibes Gaming. But there are also other big outfits out there who do this stuff still, like IGN. IGN is huge. And they cover every major convention. So, you know, they'll be at Summer Game Fest next month along with me. And, you know, and IGN has millions of subscribers and viewers across all their platforms. So there are still the big players out there. But really, it is more about individual content creators now, I would say. So, you know, instead of G4, I'm the only one of my team who lives in L.A. And Summer Game Fest is in L.A. So I'm the one going to Summer Game Fest, playing these games, gathering gameplay impressions, taking footage, interviewing developers, instead of what would have been maybe G4 doing it years ago.
Yeah, I guess the accessibility has changed things because the ability for us to be able to, like, when I was talking about, I was doing video at comic book conventions 20 years ago with a crappy 1080 camcorder.
Yeah.
You know, and I was recording separate audio to a Sony Discman.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, like, okay.
Hell yeah.
Is it in here? Oh, I don't have it in here anymore. I used to have it up on the wall. There was a Sony mini Discman that I would record the audio to, and it eventually gave out. I used to have it on the wall. Is it no longer there? I guess not. Okay. Yeah, no, I mean, the ability to record audio and video was so hard, and now everybody can do it, and we're all in our pockets.
Phones, too. Yeah.
Totally like, the accessibility of just good quality cameras, but not even just talking about cell phones, but, like, the ability just to get a DSLR into a place and record video and the ability to edit now is so much more accessible. So I guess it was the larger conglomerates like the G4s, if you want to call them that, and the MTV Geek, and Spike TV was doing Comic-Con coverage for a while.
Spike TV, yeah.
Yeah, you rolled your eyes because we both had the same feelings. It was the broiest of comic book reviews ever. It was like failed sports announcers. They're like, hey, you want to come over here and talk about comic books? I don't know what they are. Is that the things that kids I used to beat up used to read? And all right, cool.
They had the Spike TV Video Game Awards, which were horrifically misogynist and just very bro-y, all locker room talk. And it wasn't even about the games. It was about just exactly what Spike TV was all about. I don't miss that at all. I don't miss that kind of coverage whatsoever.
Best video game short, Daisy Duke shorts goes to Lara Croft from Tomb Raider.
Exactly. Stuff like that. It's I don't miss. And honestly, I don't, you know, I used to watch X-Play back in the day, too. But even then, I knew there was, at least for me, something off about their coverage in terms of it didn't all feel very genuine to me. They were very, if you go back and watch it now, it's really hard because they were very anti-Japanese games. Like, they were super against, like, Nintendo, Square Enix, or Squaresoft. Like they were much more into Western-developed games and just kind of tend to push
Rockstar-developed
games off as just kind of, like, for babies or for nerds or weeaboos or whatever. I was not a fan of their coverage either, to be honest.
Which is also hard for me to admit because friend, not of the podcast, but friend of mine, I have to say in finger quotes, Katie Linendahl, who is a tech media journalist.
Okay.
Was a part of the Spike coverage for a while. And I'm like,
oh, was she?
Get away from these guys, please.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad she did.
Yeah. Well, she's all very independent now. That's a whole different thing. But also, gotcha. You know, Spike went away. So as far as I know, so it's like everyone got away from Spike. So let's start with the beginning with your video games, because like I said, we're close to the same age. We're about 5 or so years apart. I'm 43 today.
Okay.
Today.
Yeah. Oh, happy
birthday. Moving on. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yes, it is. Thank you. I know. I didn't mean. Now I feel like when there's like, oh, I'm going to drop. It's my birthday. Okay. Anyway.
Oh, happy
birthday. By the way, by the time everyone hears this, don't drop happy birthdays in the comments, which nobody leaves anything in the comments anyway, other than, you know, hatred and vitriol. But the, so I'm 43. You're, you know, mid to late 30s. You're a couple years younger than me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, we kind of grew up with the same level of technology. Like, I had, you know, I first game unit was an Atari that we plugged up to the TV. You had to use an adapter. And we had two games. We had Pac-Man and we had Space Invaders.
Nice.
Because they didn't make any more games for it.
Right.
You know, and then by the late 80s, early 90s, the NES system came out. And the only reason we got one is because I think my cousin's grandparents bought him a new version. And then he gave us, they repackaged their old version into a box and gave it to me, my brother, my sister for Christmas. And then a couple years later, the whole family gift was a Game Boy. And that was it. And we never really had very many games.
Okay.
You know, like my cousin, when he got upgraded to Super Nintendo, he gave us his 200 games, but it was already like by the time our NES system was busted. You know, like it's like, so we never really had like the Ninja Turtles game dying for, wanted my entire life.
Oh, yeah.
By the time it was given to me by somebody else, I was like, well, my NES doesn't work, so, So I never got into gaming myself. I follow it sometimes. I wish I did. There's, so like, the Jedi's legend, the...
Jedi Fallen Order?
Fallen Order is a fun one, but the Old Republic. When they announced Old Republic, I'm like, this is the Star Wars content I want.
Uh-huh.
I want to play games. And then also when you look at $400 for a PS4 or whatever it was when it was new, I was like,
sure.
Not in my price range of things. So gaming was never for me, even though I grew up in the world when gaming was the newest, hottest thing. mm-hmm. you know, but I still have that generation of like, go outside and play, but we also had video games. So where was it? What was your first game unit, and what is the game unit that got you hooked?
Well, they're both one and the same. The first console I ever got was the original Nintendo. That's what I first grew up with. So the NES, I got it with Super Mario Brothers and Duck Hunt, and the Ninja Turtles game, actually. And that I was just, my mom played with me for the first few months, I think. She would play Mario, you know, the original Super Mario Brothers with me, but it very quickly became clear to her that this was like my thing, and that she just, you know, she loved watching it as an onlooker and playing certain games with me. Like later she would play some puzzle games with me, like Dr. Mario or Tetris, and we'd play those games together. But gaming just very quickly became my thing. And, you know, once I held that controller in my hands for the first time, it was just a transformative experience for me. So I grew up with the NES and then the Super NES, eventually got a Sega Genesis. And then just from there, N64, PlayStation 1, 2, GameCube, just throughout the years, Xbox 360. So it's just, but yeah, I started with the original NES and, you know, with games like, again, the original Super Mario Brothers, Mega Man. I'm a huge Mega Man fan, and that I got that started back in those days. The first Mega Man game I ever played was Mega Man 3, and I still remember getting it for, I believe, the holidays one year, and I just couldn't put it down. And I've been a lifelong Mega Man fan ever since. I mean, I've got a little acrylic standee right here next to me, of course, and yeah, so that's just it. It just became the thing for me, and I grew up being subscribed to all the video game magazines at the time, so Electronic Gaming Monthly, Nintendo Power, Game Pro, Game Informer, and I remember how exciting the experience of seeing a new issue waiting for you in the mailbox was every month, and that kind of was what pushed me to want to write about games myself and do and cover and talk about games for people myself. But then by the time I got to college, print journalism was kind of out of fashion, out of vogue, and it was more all about, you know, online, internet stuff. So I went more in that direction, which eventually led me to YouTube and doing gaming content on YouTube.
But, well, let's talk about the journalism side of it, because very much like me, as somebody who went into radio, I grew up with the radio playing in my house all the time. Mm-hmm. And to me, radio combined all of my favorite things, mm-hmm. which was music and comedy, mm-hmm. and being at the center of attention, but yeah, uh-huh. that's a whole different story. But
right.
So that's why I went into the world of radio. I looked for growing up trying to figure out how do I get into radio. So that was on the radio. The radio was on all the time. So I was like, this is what I wanted to do. Same way, similar to you, where you're playing your video games, you're getting these video game magazines. And you're like, oh, this guy is writing an article about a video game that I love. How do I write articles about video games I love? So what was it that made you know that you were going to go to school for journalism?
I think it's just that there was never really anything else. I mean, I've always been good at communicating. I've always been good at, you know, relaying my thoughts, either whether it's, you know, through writing or through speaking like I do now in front of the microphone. I've always been good at communicating and relating to other people and sharing my thoughts on things I'm passionate about. And so for me, there's just never was anything else, I think. And so it just kind of felt like a natural thing for me to do, to go to school for journalism. And so
did. Were you in like high school? Like, were you the school newspaper or something like that? Did you take creative writing classes?
I did take creative writing classes. I was part of a college newspaper, the first college I went to. I was part of their newspaper, and I did some gaming stuff for them. High school,
because I started for like doing like very like basic homemade multi-track recordings of my friends' bands.
Right, right.
With like Sound Blaster Studios and a tape deck.
So it was during my high school years that I actually just reached out to various, you know, publications and such, and just, you know, and also just started sharing my own works online and just kind of just writing. And I don't remember exactly how it happened, but that eventually led to me getting gigs with like GameShark.com to review games for them, which totally dates everything I'm talking about. I also used to write for a website called Games Are Fun, I think, during my college years. And that site is no longer around anymore. But I just kind of bounced around for various publications over the years, which ultimately eventually led me to YouTube. But yeah, I would say starting in my high school or college years, I was just writing about games because I was passionate about them. And I was part of some clubs, some like online clubs back in the days of like AOL and Prodigy. And so I would, you know, write newsletters and write, you know, forum posts. And I was very lucky to be able to start covering E3 from younger than I really should have been able to. I was able to get in at like 16 or 17 for the first time somehow. And so I would write about my cover. I would write my covers literally in newsletters or in forum posts that would be sent out to my friends in these clubs. And I just kind of, that just eventually got parlayed into writing gigs and reviewing gigs. And it just kind of all snowballed from there.
See, I think that's where the, when the difference between your career and my career have been is that I'm too lazy to write. So like when I was coming up in the days where there was print journalism, I shunned it because I'm like, audio is the way to go. Audio is the future. Video is the future.
Right.
And I kept pushing that way too early and no one wanted video content. Nobody wanted audio content. You know, even working in radio is hard sell to be like, here's the sounds of interviews at a convention. And they're like, nobody cares. Like, I'm not going to say I was a pioneer, but I was ahead of the curve of a lot of things before there was an ability. Like, I was doing internet radio in 1999.
Nice.
When people's computers couldn't stream radio.
Right. Well, I definitely, it's funny. I used to be passionate about writing at that age. And, you know, that was a good thing because it got me into everything I'm into now. But these days, I don't really have that same passion for writing anymore, which is why I'm glad I'm on YouTube now, because I much prefer, like I've learned that I love being in front of the mic. I love talking to people. I love, it's just more extemporaneous and more natural for me than, and I still do have to write for like YouTube content. I do still have to write scripts and record them and stuff, but I don't have that drive and passion for writing that I used to in my high school and college days. And now I'm much happier being in front of the mic, doing exactly stuff like this and recording content for my channel and streaming for our community and streaming, you know, I prefer that over writing a lot now. It's just, I don't have that same drive for writing as I used to.
Yeah. The difference between like writing scripts and writing content is that people will read your content. People don't read the scripts.
Right.
You can do shorthand. You don't have to be like, my notes are bullet points. They're like, my notes are just three words, and then question mark? That was, all I could do is look down and go, oh, so you also used to be a PA at Nickelodeon. Tell me about that. See, I don't write the sentence out. I just say, Nickelodeon? And then I know what that means. So there's a difference. I don't mind handwriting my notes when it comes to prepping my interviews, but if I had to write out this question for you to answer and then write out your answer or response, which I did. I mean, I worked for a newspaper for a little while, but calling me a writer is a stretch of the term because I would interview people vocally, record the interviews. I would then have AI transcribe it for me. I'd give that to the editor. He'd proofread it, publish it, send me a check. I was stealing from a nonprofit. It really is not calling me a writer.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
But, you know, there's still like, I have to write the podcast description, which AI is now getting involved on that too. And I was like, AI is a better writer than I am. I'm not pro AI taking jobs, but I mean, if AI gets really good at telling jokes and interviewing people, I'm going to be out of work very quickly.
Well, let's hope that doesn't happen.
No, hopefully not. I'll be fine. Can you, the AI wars are going to come down to my podcast and YouTube show. That's But on the, so moving on that subject of when your time at Nickelodeon working as a production assistant, was that during your college years or was that your first post-college job?
That was my first real like post-college job. My first couple of jobs out of college were I managed a yogurt shop for a while. And then I worked at Nexon, which is a Korean game developer responsible for games like Maple Story. And so I worked for them as a kind of a tester for a while. And then like my first big job out of after that, though, was Nickelodeon as a PA. And it was there were ups and downs. I can say that much. I had a great time working on show. I was basically a PA.
I mean, look, by the way, this is not Quiet on the Set documentary questioning for your time at Nickelodeon.
Oh, no, for sure. No, for sure. And there were definitely ups. I mean, like I had a great time working as a PA on Tough Puppy and Fairly Odd Parents. And it was really cool too, because, you know, we both know my dad is like a huge voice actor and, you know, he worked on both those shows too. So it was cool to get to have my first experience, you know, kind of helping to produce a show that my dad was on too. It was casting in and, or cast in. And so that was cool. And I met some really cool, like, you know, fellow production assistants and stuff. But it was definitely an issue of there being real no real upward mobility. Everybody above me was happy where they were. And so there was really no room to move for the people at the bottom. And
a common story in the industries where it's like,
yeah,
somebody's good at their job and they just stay there. They have no reason to move. And there's no reason for you to move no matter what you want.
Exactly. And bless him, my boss there, he was the nicest, kindest, just fairest guy. And he took, you know, he kind of called me into his office one day knowing that I had been kind of seeking a promotion for a while. And he's like, look, man, I'm going to level with you. You're very good at your job. And if I could promote you right now, I would. But the truth is everybody above you and me is happy where they are. I can't move up. It's going to be very hard for you to, because there's just no room for you to. Nobody wants to move. And he's like, so I love having you. I think you're awesome at your job, and I would never want to lose you, but I have to be honest with you, and I don't want to waste your time. And he's like, you know, if you're interested in moving up, or if you're interested in doing something else, I think you need to think about, you know, what you're doing, and maybe consider some other options. So bless him.
What was your day-to-day workload like at working on cartoons like Fairly Odd Parents?
Oh, man. I would help set up the pitches for every new episode, like in the pitching process. So me and the other PAs would go to, there was like a pitch room, and we'd set up the storyboards, pin everything to the boards, and get everything set, all the equipment set up for the showrunner, Butch Hartman, to come in and pitch the episode. And then I would go through and call out the storyboards and call out characters, props, and backgrounds that needed to be designed, and send those lists of assets off to the artists for them to start creating. And that was, honestly, that was the brunt of it. I would say the majority was drafting lists of needed assets for each episode, basically characters, backgrounds, props, and then also prepping each pitch.
Okay. That was his production assistant is such a broad term in our in the entertainment industry. It could be locations, it could be scripting, it could be budgeting, it could be on set, it could be an animation. I would not be able to tell you what a production assistant does in animation. Hear that you're, you know, I mean, you go through, like, I've been through plenty of scripts where you have to highlight every single prop and different get a different one and every different location and every different sound effect with different highlighters and go through that. And I've done that for, you know, live theatrical, but it never occurred to me that somebody would have to highlight the props in the scripts and then tell the animators, hey, FYI, the episode coming up that you're going to be drawing, we need a teddy bear. Start drawing versions of teddy bears.
That's exactly what I did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That never would occur to me that somebody would have to tell them, warn them ahead of time, hey, we need 16 different types of teddy bear drawings.
Right.
Get to work, guys.
And there would also be times where I would, you know, I would have to go through all the asset repositories and see if there were existing assets that were close enough to what was being asked for in this new episode to then not have the artist draw something that's mostly the same as something they've already done. So there's a lot of cross-referencing that.
If they're referencing something that happened that they had before,
right,
you have to find to make sure, oh, this wand that they talked about in episode 3 that they're bringing up in episode 15
exactly
has to be the exact same one. So instead of redrawing it from scratch and creating a new one and have a continuity error.
Right.
Stuff like that. Wow. Exactly. That's,
so that's basically exactly what I did at Nickelodeon.
Oh, that's so much like research right there of just going through lots animated images and like, I do not envy that. Like I have a very obsessive compulsive disorder and it is to my detriment sometimes where I have to obsessively look for things to clear them. So that would not have been the PA job for me. I'm more of a on set. If I would do a PA job, it would have been more on set, with the exception of I've worked with other people on set and I can't stand most of them.
Oh, fair enough. Well, it worked out for me because I've also been a copy editor in my career. So attention to detail is kind of my thing. I'm very good at picking out little details. And I'm one of those really annoying people who will notice misspellings on billboards or things and call them out. And you know, just one of those annoying people who calls out every misspelling he sees. I'm very much a detail oriented guy.
So am I, but it's like to my detriment, to my unhealthy mental well-being sometimes. That's where I can't shut it off or I can't just accept them sometimes. It's a problem, but
I got you.
Like working as, you know, doing background on movies and TV shows, I don't know if you've ever had to do it, but there are so many dumb questions asked by background. Like, the biggest dumb question that would drive me the nuts on set the most is, say they split us into three different groups, right? And then a PA will come out and go, all right, everybody in group A, we're going to need you to come to set because we're going to be doing this, this, and that. All righty? And then somebody would inevitably stand up and go, what if you're in group B? Then nobody's talking to you!
Yeah, Common sense isn't common. Sadly. No.
And yeah, if I was the PA, I would lose my shit every single time that would happen. Uh-huh. And I, as an actor in group C, I would lose my shit.
Right.
They'd be like, what about us and B? Like, nobody's talking to you! I'm going to go back over here to Crafty!
Yeah. I hear you. When common sense is lost on people, it drives me crazy.
So while working at Nickelodeon, what was the, if you wanted to upgrade your path there, what was it, what were the jobs that you were looking or hoping that would open up for you before you left there? What were you looking to be a writer or?
I wasn't quite sure, but if I had kept going on the production path, the natural path forward would be production coordinator, then production manager, line producer, you know, if I had stayed there over the years, but that was just a matter of luck and just waiting to see if anything would even open up. And I had already been there for almost 2 years as a PA with no chance of moving up. And it was because my boss was like, hey, you're great. And I'd promote you if I could, but there literally is no path right now, no matter how.
So what was the next on the career path then?
So that whole time I had been working part time for a company called Udon Entertainment, which they are a publisher of video game and anime art books and manga and comics and stuff. So I'd been working part time with them for a long time, copy editing art books kind of as a side job. And I approached my boss there and said, hey, you know what? This whole full time thing at Nickelodeon is not really working out. I'm looking to make a move. And I've obviously been working for you guys for a couple of years already part time. And if you will have me, if there's room for me, I would love to work for you guys full time. And thankfully that was possible. And we, you know, negotiated that. And so for the next several years, I worked for Udon full time. And that was, so basically I was full time. I was their senior editor, editing all their art books, their manga, comics, things like that. And that's had a huge impact on me. I still talk to them to this day. I'm still doing freelance work for Udon to this day. Have a lot of friends at that company, and I got some of the best opportunities of my career and of my life through that job. And
so it's comic book editing.
More for me, art books. So art books. You know, for me, they hired me not only for my copy editing expertise, but also my gaming background. So for me, anime. So for me, they primarily put me on their video game and anime art books and their manga. I did a few comics, especially their Street Fighter comics, because they have a bunch of Capcom franchises they work with, chiefly Street Fighter and Mega Man, I would say. So they hired me primarily, though, for both my copy editing expertise and mainly my gaming background. So okay. I did a few comics, but mainly their anime and game art books.
Okay, and so what? Do me a favor, give me like a detail, because when I know something, I'll tell you, I know what it is, but explain it for the listeners. This is something I have no idea what it is. Is what would copy editing for art books be? Because I know what a copy editor does in a newsroom. Mm-hmm. I know what a copy editor does at like a publishing firm or like an advertising firm.
Right.
But a copy editor is another one of those, like much like the word producer, where it's like it's a word that we stick on different things. And as like a producer in radio, LinkedIn goes, hey, do you want to be a producer at this factory? I'm like, no, that is not my skill set at all. Right. Watching a factory line is not producing a radio show.
Right.
Get your shit together, LinkedIn. So for copy editing for art books, what, I don't even know what you would do because I'm ignorant. Not because, what kind of job is that?
No, I know. So basically, I mean, it would be the same thing. I don't know if you have any other, I mean, you know, they have art books for like movies and stuff, like Star Wars art books and whatever. I'm sure the MCU has its own whole collection of books. But, you know, oftentimes, art books, it's not just the art. They'll have interviews or pull quotes from the artists and developers behind a game. Oftentimes these art books also serve as source books for game lore or, you know, things like, so there'll be interviews to edit. There'll be game lore that's written in the book that I'm going to go through. Pull quotes from artists and things. And it's also about making sure all the character names and stuff and terms are correct. So, you know, you'll get, let's say, you know, I did a bunch of Mega Man art books Mega Man has a ton of characters, and they need somebody who knows his Mega Man to be able to go through and make sure that every character is labeled properly, everything's spelled right, all the terms are correct, all the lore is correct. So, as senior editor, part of that was copy editing, part of that was cross-referencing, you know, with information to make sure I had everything correct. Part of that was just pulling on my natural knowledge of these franchises to be the right guy for the job to make sure everything was correct. So that's essentially what I did. It wasn't just copy editing, but that was part of it. But it was also just making sure everything was lore accurate. Everything was that when a fan like me were to pick up the book and read through it, that they wouldn't then go like, oh, whoever was responsible for the English version of this book has never played a Mega Man game in their life. They have no, this is misspelled. This item name is wrong. This weapon name is wrong. Making sure that it was the authentic fan experience. If someone like me picked it up, that I would be impressed that the guy who did this knew what they were doing.
Continuity was a big part of your job, which definitely. I can definitely say there was a time where reading comics where they did not care about continuity and it drove certain people crazy. And
I'm that person who would be driven crazy by something like that.
Okay. So it's good to know that because anime is not my thing. I don't care for the artwork. I don't care for the style.
Oh wow, I love anime.
I I've been to Otakon a bunch of times. The cosplay at Otakon puts everyone else's cosplay to shame.
Uh-huh.
I love the passion, but I like even when Marvel did those anime versions of some of their Marvel stuff.
Oh, what if
Marvel properties? Not the what ifs, but like they a couple years ago an anime studio did like a Wolverine anime and they did a Black Widow anime. And I was just like, I don't care for the vignetting. I don't like the style of it. It just doesn't speak to me. It's great.
Gotcha.
It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. I love that it's out there, but it doesn't appeal to me.
Gotcha.
Like I was not Pokemon. I was not Dragon Ball Z, you know, like Vampire Hunter D was about the closest anime that I could sustain. And even that was too weird for me. I was like, his hand talks and eats dirt. He kills vampires.
For me, I'm full on like Final Fantasy, Kingdom Hearts, you know, Pokemon, all that stuff. Dragon Ball, Sailor Moon. I'm like fully all about it. I love all that power of friendship, anime, over the top nonsense. I love it. I'm all about it.
Yeah. Now my brother,
I have Sonic on my shirt too, which is you know not anime, but pretty anime styled. So
yeah, I think what it was is my older brother showed me Akira too early, and it just turned me off. I'm like,
that's
this,
pretty intense.
Not for me. Yes.
Yeah, that's a pretty intense entryway into anime for sure.
Yeah. When your first anime is Akira.
Yeah.
Like I get how it's an experience.
Yeah.
But it is not an experience I want to ever again. I do think sometimes I was like, maybe I should go back and as an older adult and rewatch it. And then I see clips sometimes for whatever reason.
Nah,
I went,
good.
No. Yeah, I'm staying on the same thing. Like Silence of the Lambs was too much for me. Too young. Silence did the same things when I was too young. And I'm like Buffalo, like unedited. Like I watched The Godfather on like network TV, and I get it. It's a hard watch with commercials, but you know you can get through it.
Sure.
Silence of the Lambs and Akira, no, thank you.
Gotcha.
But so there was I'm imagining there's got to be a lot of difficulty in maintaining that continuity for anime because you're talking about a media that's created in a foreign language and then translated to a different language. So you don't have, you know, trying to maintain that integrity of it probably is much more difficult than Western created content media.
It could be, especially for animes with which I had no prior experience. I mean, I did some anime art books for series that I hadn't watched before. So to be clear, I wasn't the translator. We would have someone else translate, and then I would go through and clean up the English text and make it, you know, as pristine as possible.
Yeah, make it sound like English text instead of backwards. Yeah.
But there were some anime art books I did for series I hadn't watched. So I had to very meticulously not only watch the series, but refer to wikis and other source materials to make sure that I was getting character names correct. And location names and story details correct for shows that I wasn't that familiar with. You know, I mean, I love anime, but I'm more in the gaming side of things. So my natural expertise is in gaming, and anime, I'm like a little bit secondary. Even though I love it, I haven't watched nearly as many animes as I have played games. So especially with the anime source books, I would have to be really meticulous in my cross-referencing with various wikis and other source materials to make sure I got everything right.
Yeah, and like I've been watching so many videos recently of like I think both Nerdist and another YouTube channel try to connect the old late 90s or the 90s, early 2000 Marvel animated series.
Oh, really? Okay.
The mess that these shows were, whether if they were connected or not, which we all know they weren't.
Right.
Because they were different production studios and different licenses and stuff, but they tried, and it's like, when you try to piece these together, you're like, it's mind-numbingly annoying on how different the continuity is between some of these. So I can imagine when you are doing it on purpose, at least when somebody's like, you have to be the guy that goes, well, actually.
Yeah, exactly. Or I have to be the guy that makes sure those people don't get the chance to do that. Don't have a reason to do that. Yeah.
So you said you're working part for that time for them. Did you leave them to start Game Explain?
So I didn't start Game Explain. I was the.
I know you're a part of it, but I meant like.
Yeah. So I did eventually leave Udon to do more full time gaming content creation with. Well, it wasn't just for that. It was Game Explain, and then there were also other production jobs I was being offered. Like I got to work on a game called Hive Swap, which is a game based on the Homestuck webtoon. And that they were going to pay me pretty well to do that. And it was more than what I was making in Udon. So I kind of stepped away from that to go back to part-time there to take on other opportunities that were coming my way. Then those came and went. And then I eventually landed, as you said, at Game Explain. And that happened because I met the number two at Game Explain at an E3. We were sitting down for a roundtable for Pokemon X and Y, a roundtable discussion by the developers. And I happened to sit next to him. His name's Derek, and I work with him now at our current channel. And he saw my name tag. He's like, oh, you know, Ash Paulson. Like, and he's like, don't worry, I'm not going to say what you think I'm going to say, which is I'm a big fan of your dad. I think your dad's really cool. But actually, I'm a big fan of your work, and I'd love to have you on Game Explain to talk about whatever, the, you know, various things. I'd like, dude, I'm a huge fan of Game Explain. It'd be my honor. And so they basically had me. It kind of became a running joke. After that E3, he contacted me. And I would be on Game Explain, various Game Explain discussions as a recurring special guest until it just became clear that I was no longer a recurring guest, but just the number three person at Game Explain. Basically,
which
they would have me on.
Explain what Game Explain is, because is it a podcast? Is it
a
video show, streaming show?
So it's a YouTube channel that I used to work for, and they just do gaming content like reviews, news, features, things like that. They're still around today. I don't work for them anymore. Basically, we were there for, God, a good 7-8 years, I want to say. And then we eventually, as the channel grew bigger, unfortunately, we were just kind of being taken advantage of in terms of being underpaid, overworked. And the guy who runs it just wasn't treating us fairly. So I eventually rallied everyone. Well, one of the guys left because he couldn't take it anymore and went to go work for a different channel. And then after he left, I rallied the rest of us and I said, hey, guys, you know what? If we're going to be working this hard, let's be doing something that is ours. Let's be lining our own pockets, not somebody
else's.
Before
we talk about good game vibing, though, I am curious about Game Explain and in that, because when you were there, that was... You know, we're talking, you started there, you know, you said you worked with them 7-8 years ago. Time frame puts you about 10 years ago.
Right? Seven to 8 years, but not 8 years ago. Good Vibes Gaming is going into its fourth year, I believe.
Yeah. The timeline I'm putting in my head is it was right when YouTube vlogging was big.
Yeah.
Which I would say YouTube vlogging is not big anymore.
And so it's more competitive. I would say it's still pretty big, but it's... Okay. Definitely a more competitive space than it used to be.
Yeah, because like probably about 15 years ago, I was enamored with YouTube vlogging in that it became such a great network and outlet for people that I did not see coming. And so like I was trying to make streaming happen 15 years ago. We were at the radio station I worked for, we did a live radio show from a nightclub where we had a DJ in the club spin in the club, and I would broadcast while we were spinning. And at the same time, we were trying to live stream that show when it was just like two streaming platforms, Ustream and Justin TV, you know, and like none of the other engineers knew anything about streaming. I was doing it all on my own, figuring out how to do all this. while at the same time watching how YouTube was blowing up with YouTube's next-gen studios and early content creation, which Game Explained timeframe puts them right around there, where yeah. there was a lot of, like, YouTube was putting money into creators, and there was money to be made from the advertising yeah. and stuff like that. So that's when I'm, that's where, was Game Explained part of a larger conglomerate, or was it completely independent? Where was the funding coming from, and did part of the problem with funding come from YouTube has taken away so many people's access to funding now, not in a way of censorship where those other comedians like, oh, I can't say the word. I can't say the F word or the R word anymore, or otherwise I get demonetized. No, in that YouTube is literally giving creators less money than they were before. And so a lot of people are in that. Is that your experience? Because I a lot of yeah. the YouTubers I know are having to cut down the amount of content they do and create different avenues of revenue in addition to still creating their YouTube shows.
Definitely. I mean, at GVG, we have a team of six, and all but one of us have other jobs we have to do. We can't all do it full time because we don't make enough money to. With GX, it was definitely a different time in the space. There was more money to be had, for sure. And I don't doubt that during the later years that we were there at GX, that the revenue was going down. But that still doesn't really account for the fact that we were being exploited to hell and back. And so even if there was less money, 90% of that money was going to the guy who owned the channel, and the rest of us were left to kind of just, you know, well, I should say us and the guy at the top, and then the number two. But the number two was working obscenely hard for what he was making, and was required to be on call at all hours of the night, all weekends. Like, it was just, we were being exploited, which is why we eventually left. But I don't doubt get back to your point. I don't doubt that during the years closer to when we left, there was less revenue going into the channel, for sure, which is, you know, probably what caused some of the exploitation, I'm sure. But it's still, you know, we're all much happier now working, you know, on our own thing, Good Vibes Gaming, and having something that is ours, that the profits, you know, we profit from directly. Even if it isn't full-time pay, it's still ours. And we're still making more than we did back at GX working full-time. So it's definitely something where the situation has both improved but also gotten more difficult in terms of, yes, the content creator space on YouTube is not only way more competitive than it used to be, but there's also just less money to go around, for sure. And advertising revenue is down. We're still getting good, sponsorship opportunities, but there aren't as many as there used to be. And they're not necessarily as pricey as they used to be either. So there's definitely, sponsorship opportunities are down across the board. Ad revenue is kind of down across the board. So it's a tougher space than it used to be, but we're still happier doing our own thing, even if we can't all do it full time yet, you know?
Okay. So in the YouTube space, now that you guys are Good Vibe Gaming, what's the difference between the Good Vibe Gaming channel and the Game Explained channel?
So we founded our channel on the name and the concept kind of came from me, and I shared it with the rest of the group, and they loved it. And so we founded our channel on the pillars of inclusivity, kindness, anti-toxicity, and pushing back against all the horrific bullying and other toxic behavior that goes on in the gaming space, and basically wanting to establish a space for people to be their authentic selves from every background, all races, all gender identities, all sexualities. It's, you know, we want people, you know, there's so much of a toxic white guys club mentality in gaming where a lot of people out there would have you believe that it's a space for straight white men only. And we reject all that. We're like, no, we welcome everybody from all backgrounds. We've established an incredibly positive, kind, diverse Discord community for our subscribers and people who like watching us. And that's kind of become core to our identity. So that's definitely one thing that sets us apart from GX. Not that GX is against any of that. They're not, but that's just not what they were founded on. Also, our content's different. We're not doing the same kind of content that we did at GX. A little bit of it is the same, but we're doing less traditional style content and more features, which has been kind of a challenge for me because I'm more of a traditionally trained journalists. So fortunately, we're getting back into doing more traditional style stuff like reviews and previews and such. But we do a lot more features with very specific focuses than I would say we did at GX. GX was mainly all traditional style content. Now we're doing a lot more features. We're doing more live streams. We're doing reaction streams. We're doing a weekly podcast. We also have a Patreon. We do Patreon exclusive content. So I'd say a lot of what we do at GVG now is more focused on very specific topics than just your typical reviews and news and such. Although, like I said, we are starting to get back into that because we had a one particular preview for the upcoming Paper Mario game that did incredibly well for us. And we're trying to capitalize on that and bring back some more of that traditional style content, because that's personally what I excel at, and I'm not as good at the feature type stuff.
So yeah, is playthrough part of the channel too, or play along? Is that what they call it when
let's
play plays. A video
no,
game?
We don't do let's plays. No, okay, let's plays. I think in general are kind of the popularity of let's plays has kind of dwindled a little bit. I don't think they're quite as big as they used to be.
I would think so, because a lot of the YouTube content creators that I watched, you know, back in the, like the Freddie Wong. Mm-hmm. Like Freddie W. He was a great YouTube creator for special effects and movie, and all of it was based around video games. Corridor Digital, another mm-hmm. one that did so much movie content about video games and stuff like that, and special effects and digital editing and stuff. And a lot of them moved to Let's Plays, mm-hmm. and because that's where they saw the thing was going. And now, like, a lot of those channels are defunct. I don't see people talking about them as much. But I guess a lot of that. How much of that do you think is moved from YouTube to Twitch? Like, how many people?
You see people following along with people playing games way more on Twitch than you do YouTube now. And that's, I'd still say that space is huge on Twitch, but on YouTube, it's very, I'd say it's reserved for a few very high profile content creators. There's actually one guy I'm a big fan of. His name's Maximilian Dude. And I like to follow his playthroughs on things because he and I are passionate about a lot of the same things. So I like to see his reactions to big moments in certain games, and but he's got like millions of subscribers. He's huge, which is one of the reasons he can still get away with doing Let's Plays on YouTube, because he's massive.
Yeah. I think also a lot of people age out of that. Like, it is traditionally not to be pejorative, but on this subject, because I don't understand who wants to sit around and watch somebody play a video game.
yeah.
Like the same thing when it comes to that as a podcaster, me, everyone tells me that, or not everyone, I hear a lot of people go, oh, my kid watches this because it's like him hanging out with his friend. Like,
that's what
I've heard
too. Yeah.
Yeah, I get that a little bit, but at the same time, like, I feel like the content has to be good. Like, there's too many podcasts going into the realm of too many white dudes sitting around talking about why they should be allowed to say the N-word as comedians. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to hear that content any more than I want to watch somebody play a video game. But I get where I want to listen to, I've met Chad Daniels. I've worked with Chad Daniels, a mm-hmm. great comedian. And he has two podcasts, one where he does with his girl, do a vice show with his fiance and then, or girlfriend who's also a comedian. And he has another show with another comedian. And I like listening to Chad. I like Chad Daniels as a person. So that's why I listen to his podcast, because I don't get to hang out with him all the time. So I can hang out with him audibly on with my earphones in and talk to myself and respond to him and probably sound like a psychopath on the Boston subway system.
And see, that's the key though. And what's funny is that it's really not so different for Twitch streamers or people who watch. Like I said, I don't have a lot of time to watch other people play games because I play games myself, and that's not how I want to spend most of my time. But when I do watch this guy, Maximilian Dude, and I want to see his reactions to certain things in the games I'm playing, it's not because I want to sit down and watch someone play a game. It's because I want, it's about his personality. It's about the person. I want to see his reactions. I want to hear his thoughts because he and I are passionate about the same things. I could sit down and watch anybody play a game, but it's not about the game. It's about the person you're watching. Yeah. And so I think that's what it is for these kids too, is like, I don't get it either. I know there are kids who will just watch Twitch streams all day of people playing games, and that's not how I'd want to spend my day. But I also get that for a lot of these kids, it's because they're connecting with the personalities who are playing the game.
I mean, I guess it's similar in the way that I watch a couple of particular YouTube woodworker channels, because I say it satiates my need for creating crafted wood art.
Right.
I grew up with construction. I like to make things with my hands, but I don't have a shop. I don't have the tools. I don't have the time to sit around and do those things. So I'll put on Adam Savage Tested, or I'll put on Make Something with David Picciuto. Mm-hmm. And then YouTube will offer me other people's channels, and I'll look at it, I'll watch it and go, ugh, I don't like this guy. And I'll stop watching it.
Yeah, it's about to
And it is, I go to David Picciuto because I like him. I want to hang out with David Picciuto.
And so I watch people make furniture. That's also what I hear from people who are in our audience. You know, we're at about 170,000 subs on YouTube now. And, you know, a lot of what I hear from the people in our audience at GVG is, you know, they can get gaming content anywhere. There's gaming content everywhere now, obviously on YouTube and Twitch. But the people who subscribe to us is because they like, thankfully, fortunately, and I'm grateful for this, they like us as personalities. They want to hear what we have to say. They want to hear what I and all of us have to say, specifically because they think our viewpoints are interesting or valuable in specific ways that maybe they're not getting from other channels or whatever. So there's so much quality content out there, and I'm just thankful that there are people out there who find our viewpoints and what we do to be uniquely valuable. And, you know, that can be said for so many other successful channels out there as well. It's a crowded space, but we've been able to eke out a little space for ourselves where people come to us because they want our content.
And I'm just going to put this, I'm not great with timing on this, but I'm pretty sure they're similar around the same time of good vibe gaming started right around Gamergate, didn't it?
This was way after Gamergate.
Was it way after? It was way that after. Long ago? Because I feel like it's like 4 years ago, but.
No, Gamergate was more like a decade ago.
It really? Wow.
Yeah.
Dude, you know, the pandemic really screws up a lot of my timeline in my life. Like to me, I think I just lost my job in radio just a year or two ago, but it was 2018.
Oh, I know. The pandemic has just messed the whole concept of the flow of time up, right?
Okay.
So I just looked it up to make sure.
Because you were a journalist in the middle of the whole Gamergate thing. Can you do a quick explanation of what Gamergate was and why it is still important to this day and age for gamers?
I wouldn't say it is still important in this day and age, thankfully. I did look it up, and it was in 2014 and 2015, so about a decade ago.
It was 10 years ago. Wow.
Yeah. The people who organized it would tell you that it was about, and I use this in the heaviest air quotes possible, ethics in game journalism, but it really wasn't. It was about misogyny. It was about just trying to push women out of the gaming space and harassing women, people who identify as women. It was a hate campaign against women in gaming. That's really all it was. But they would tell you that it was about ethics in game journalism and trying to hold game journalists, you know, to account. And hey, all journalists should be held accountable, including game journalists. But that's not what Gamergate was about. It was a hate campaign against women in gaming. And that's really
they used it. I think if I remember the whole, because I had to report on it a little bit when it happened, it was two women who were game journalists that were also involved with the launch of a game that they had funded. They promoted it and people flipped out. I think that was the big catalyst. I mean, that wasn't the entire thing of what it was about, but I feel like that was the mainstream catalyst for all of it, which I can understand the point of, hey, if you're reviewing games, you should be open about, hey, I helped make this game.
Totally.
But also at the same time, are you just using that as a crutch to go, women shouldn't be in gaming and they should be in the kitchen with no shoes on making babies.
And it was also just kind of a wider push against feminism and diversity in general in gaming. It was basically just a, you know, kind of a hate campaign against women and the overall proliferation of feminism and diversity and progressivism in gaming, which I think all three of those things are great and should be everywhere in gaming, but the Gamer Gators were not a fan of that.
And then let's just talk about gaming for a moment because we brought up Twitch. Do you think Twitch is going to be the future of gaming journalism, or do you think it has its own space and that the YouTube content and Twitch can both coincide together, or do you think Twitch will eventually take over YouTube, or third option that I can't come up with?
I mean, I can't speak about a possible third option, but I think Twitch and YouTube and also, you know, more traditional gaming journalism exist in completely different spaces. Twitch is not a platform for gaming journalism or content that you consume. It's a platform for streams. And that's its own important thing. You know, connect with the streamers you like and watch them play games and have a great time, participate in their chat. That's a valuable thing in itself, but it's not journalism. It's not creating content that is meant to inform consumers or fans about a certain thing. That's more of what we do. And it's also what is still happening in print style media online. Like IGN, they have a giant website and they have a whole team of editors who are writing traditional articles, news articles, reviews, previews, features. And that's its own entirely separate thing than something happening on Twitch, which is primarily streams of you know, people playing through games. Again, not railing against that. That is valuable content in its own way, but it's not informative. It's not, you're not going to go to a Twitch stream to get a review on a game you're interested in. You're going to go to a Twitch stream maybe to watch somebody play some of it, but that's still different than writing a concise, review of something that gives your thoughts on the whole game, pros, cons, and, that's different than going to a stream and watching somebody play it for hours as they're playing a chunk of the game and talking about it as they go. Both valuable, but very different kinds of
the reason I feel like there's an overlap is because Twitch is well known for gaming, mm-hmm. but also Twitch, the platform itself, has expanded beyond gaming to where, like, the amount of mm-hmm. podcasts True. That live stream their podcast recordings on Twitch and then still mm-hmm. put them out on the other platforms. I'm wondering, for me as just comedy podcaster, mm-hmm. I do interviews, but it's all comedy podcasts. I'm mostly with most of my guests are comedians.
Right.
I'm trying to find the interesting people with jobs for my podcast, hence the reason why you're here. But, predominantly, most of the people I interact with are comedians or the platform, the guests are entertainers, artists and entertainers. That's what I call all of my guests. But 90% of them are comedians because that's who's in my circle of things, But I do, I've had musicians and other writers and anyway, actors and stuff on.
Yeah.
So I look at where the comedy podcast world is going and that people are moving more and more to stream on Twitch and then putting the content out later. There's also a lot of people that are just live streaming on YouTube and don't even realize people are listening to their audio. Like the All Things Comedy Network does almost all their podcasts on YouTube now. Mm-hmm. And then kind of forget that people are listening on the audio side of it too. I don't know if Twitch is going to become that platform for gaming too, which is mm-hmm. What reason I asked you that question. I don't know. I don't think Twitch is tech as accessible as podcasting is or YouTube mm-hmm. As is. So I don't see it as it taking over unless they can make Twitch streaming more tech easy mm-hmm. for people. And mm-hmm. I mean, dude, I started my podcast in 2015. When I had to create my own RSS feed by hand in coding.
Right.
Like, I started on the hard day. Now everyone can make a podcast with anything and everything. And for a couple bucks a month, they do all the hard work for you, where I used to have to do the hard work. So Twitch, there's still some hard work to get into the streaming side of it. I've consulted with people to help them tech-wise on some of this stuff. And when I start talking about, this is what you're going to need, I just watch their eyes glaze over.
Uh-huh.
Because they're like, if you can't figure out an audio podcast, you're not going to figure out Twitch streaming. Like,
that's for
me,
sure.
Okay?
That's for sure. Yeah. No, I think I do. Like I said, I think they both exist in their own spaces for now. I don't personally see Twitch taking everything over. I think both platforms kind of have a different focus. Then that's not to say that there's not going to be a third thing, as you said, third possible thing that comes out and overtakes everything. That could always happen, but.
Didn't know how much Instagram was going to take over Facebook and Twitter.
Right. And then TikTok blew up. So mm-hmm. I see Twitch streams kind of existing in a separate space than more traditional style content, both in writing, both in print and in video form, like what I do. I just see that as kind of a separate thing.
And now, do you have any experience with esports in that realm?
As a fan, yes, but that's about it. And really only specifically the fighting game side of things. I'm not into the big MOBA games like League of Legends or Valorant or the shooters like, Valorant's a shooter, I think. I'm more into the fighting game side of esports. Okay. So Street
because
Fighter VI,
I'm Mortal Kombat. Silicon Valley and what was that HBO show with The Rock where he was a sports... agent person money man guy
sure.
whatever that show ballers oh. both those shows did a short little dive into competitive mm-hmm. video gaming, and I honestly thought that would be a bigger deal by now.
It's a fairly mainstream. Big deal. I mean,
it's a big deal, but I feel like it's a niche. I feel still like it's a niche. That's why I'm asking you, because you would know more than I do, maybe. Is that, do we see that taking over mainstream? I don't know if it'll ever take over sports gaming, but do you think esports and competitive gaming is going to become more mainstream and less of a niche? I mean, there's a lot of money, a lot of advertising it, but it's like, the advertisers are still the people that are involved with the games. You know, you're not getting like Under Armour is not sponsoring League of Legends competitions.
Well, you know, what's funny though is actually I don't know about Under Armour specifically, but like the side of it that I'm into, fighting games, there's an annual tournament every year called Evolution, Evo for short. It's Evolution World Series, I think. And it's basically the top fighting game tournament in the world. The best players of Street Fighter, Mortal Kombat, Super Smash Brothers, Tekken, Guilty Gear, they all meet in Vegas every year for this giant fighting game tournament. And it's got, they're on stage. There's like a bunch of money in the prize pool. But they've also got major sponsorships like Chipotle. Chipotle sponsors Evo every year. So I don't know about Under Armour specifically, but these are big enough that you've got major sponsors like Chipotle on board.
I was going to also say McDonald's was going to be my alternate for the Under Armour. And I was like, but you know, everybody's Uber eating McDonald's and Taco Bell and playing video games. That's like, why would they not get into advertising?
Right.
Those people are already using their product. That's their perfect. Hey, you know, more power
Mountain
to you.
Mountain Dew is also a huge sponsor for a lot of gaming things.
Which a lot of Mountain Dew. I think this is where I thought in my head, and I just put all of this together maybe while we're talking, is that I thought esports would become the next extreme sports. Whereas, like, you know, when the X Games started coming out, the entire world was fascinated with the X Games. The entire world has not been as fascinated with esports yet the way I thought they would have, similar to the way of the X Games.
Well, I think it's a bit more of a niche appeal, right? I mean, at the end of the day, you're still, I mean, you're watching the best in the world, but at the end of the day, you're still watching the best in the world play video games. And if you're not into the games they're playing, or if you don't really know what's going on and what to look for, it's not going to be interesting to you, which is, again, I'm not into a lot of the big esports games like League of Legends or Valorant or Fortnite or things like that. Like, that's not, I guess Fortnite's less esports, but stuff like that, I'm just not into it. Because I'm not into those kinds of games, and I kind of gloss over fighting games. I'm into, so I care. But the average person probably doesn't give a damn about Street Fighter, and so if they don't, they're not going to tune into esports. So it's still very much a niche appeal, I think.
Yeah. I think about how famous Tony Hawk, Sean White, guys are, and I'm like, I can't name a single e-gamer.
Right.
You're telling me they're winning thousands upon tens of thousands of dollars at these competitions. And I can't name a single one. And I care about that world.
The only ones I can name are in the fighting game space again.
Yeah.
So, and even then I can only name a few. So it is very,
everyone can name Sean White and Tony Hawk.
Right. You know, well, I wouldn't know who Sean White is. Tony Hawk I can name. I have no idea who Sean White is, but
snowboarding.
I'm also not a traditional sports guy at all. So
if I showed you Sean White's picture, he's the one with the big red bushy hair as a snowboarder. As soon as you see the picture, you're like, I know who that guy is.
Okay. Yeah. Gotcha.
But I mean, I can rally off names. Other people can rally off names. People know what the exports are. People don't know what e-games are competitive gaming is. Like, I still think about The Wiz with Fred Savage and how
The Wizard,
epic
I love that
Mario 3 on the Super NES was, you know, like that it was in Vegas and it was this big, huge thing. And now we actually have that in real life.
Yeah.
And nobody cares. Except the people that really care.
The people who are into it really care. And I mean, I got to say, it gets...
The people who are really into it are really in it, and then that's it. There's no passing. You know, they're like, I can't imagine people are going to Vegas who aren't sports fans and are just tangentially walking into that. Whereas people will tangentially walk into, you know, an X Games or whatever.
So I just pulled some numbers just really quick.
Ooh, yes.
Evo last year, Evo 2023, the fighting game tournament, had almost 9,200 unique players and attracted 3.7 million viewers across 3 days. So, you know,
that's a lot of people that like it.
Yeah. But so it's definitely not small, but I don't think it's ever going to be mainstream necessarily.
Okay. That's where I think I wanted to know is it going to be mainstream and how do we get it there? Okay.
I think you have to care about the games being played. If you don't care about the games being played, there's really nothing there for you. Whereas,
and there's so many games out there, like the world of gaming.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like when we were growing up with NES where they made like 3 games a year.
Oh, no. I mean, like, there are games coming out left and right these days, especially in the
indie game realm too.
Yeah.
So, all right. And the last thing we're going to talk about, because you mentioned it earlier, is that your father, who is the reason why we met, because, you know, let's talk about how we met and then we'll talk about your experience growing up with that, because I'm curious about what that world like is growing up in L.A., with a father who is, your father is Rob Paulson, who is a very famous voice actor, most famously for being the voice of Pinky from Pinky and the Brain. Most people know that. He was Raphael in the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the first cartoon, or Donatello in the first cartoon, and then Raphael in the rebirth of it.
Sorry, he was Raphael first, and then Donatello later. Also, and the actor from Animaniacs.
We are, as I love to call it, pandemic friends. Regular listeners are now just groaning because I have so many pandemic friends on the podcast, and that we met during the pandemic doing a live streaming show on Zoom,
right,
where you and your father were interviewing other voice artists who were in the video game world as well.
Right.
We did it through Flappers Comedy Club, Game That Tune, which is an awesome name.
I want to repurpose it somehow and keep using it. I don't know in what form yet, but my dad and I want to bring it back in some form and keep really using that name.
One of the questions I was going to ask is, has it become the live show at Flappers now, or is it defunct?
It just kind of, it was hard to get guests who were willing to come on in person. Yeah. So it just kind of fizzled out, unfortunately. And it just became, the return we were getting for it wasn't really worth the investment in terms of time and effort. So we want to bring it back in some form. We're not really sure how, but I agree that the Game That Tune name is excellent, and I really want to keep it around.
I mean, I loved working on it. I loved working with you guys. But growing up in LA with a father who is in the entertainment industry, do you think that is something that helped lead you to also be in tangentially entertainment industry? Like,
absolutely.
You mentioned your father was working at Fairly Odd Parents, and then you got a job on Fairly Odd Parents. Did your father help you with that job?
No. No, that was very much my own thing that he happened to be working on the show, but he was already working on the show for years before I started working at Nick. So that was not related. That was all me, but definitely my experience growing up in LA, with my dad being in entertainment and watching what he does and kind of gleaning all that from him over the years definitely led me on the path I am today in terms of also being an entertainer, being not in the same way. I'm not a voice actor, although I actually now harbor a dream of getting into voice work and doing more voice acting, which I really, really want to do. But even if I'm not acting, I am in front of the mic and I'm entertaining people in my own way through gaming content and what I do. And so my overall kind of emergence as a content creator and entertainer is definitely due in no small part to everything that my dad has done over the years.
Well, growing up as a kid in LA, generally, were you already going to school around other child actors?
I guess. I probably was. I mean, the only one I know that I remember for sure was Jonathan Taylor Thomas, went to, I think, my middle school or something. But I don't remember specifically going to school with any other,
Yeah, because there's that at least that world where it's like, A, there's tons of famous people that live here, and there's also just regular people that live here.
Right.
And I guess it's all a matter of what circle you just happen to be a part of.
Yeah, I didn't really have a lot of friends growing up. I was bullied a lot. I basically just had a very, very, very small pool of friends. And I also had people who would kind of like befriend me just to get to my dad. Like, they want an autograph from my dad. And then as soon as they got one, they would stop talking to me. It wasn't always easy. But of course, I talk about that now just because it is a true lived experience that I had, but it's not something that I carry with me as something that affects me or weighs me down today. I mean, my relationship with my dad is fantastic. And, he always promotes GBG in whatever way he can and promotes me. And, we do whatever we can to help each other. We go to we make convention appearances together now. And, we're very much existing in, if not the same space, adjacent ones, because, a lot of people who love games love cartoons and vice versa. So we have a lot of fans who, he'll have fans come up to him at conventions and be like, oh man, so great to meet you, Rob. I'm also a big fan of your son, Ash, and GVG. I love all the stuff they're doing. So, you know, there's definitely a lot of cross-pollination in our respective audiences. And so we use that to kind of lift each other up. And that's been a great thing to do together.
Yeah, because your dad kind of lives in that space where it's like people know his work, but they don't know his name unless you're like really into names of things and stuff like that. So, like, I've mentioned Rob Paulson and you and plenty of times when I talk about the pandemic of what things I did during it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'll mention his name in other regards of things. And somebody go, who's Rob Paulson? I'm like, he did the voice of Yakko Warner on the.
And then they're like,
oh, okay, I know that guy. Yeah. Oh, he did that voice or Pinky in the Brain. You know, you have to kind of, you know, name his works. You know, few people know him. You know, the people who really know his name really. It's very much like, I guess, like e-gaming, where it's like, if you're really into it, you're really into it. And if you're really into Rob Paulson, you really know Rob Paulson's name.
Right.
Like, the biggest thing that stuck out in my brain for your father's work was the first episode of Batman where he just played one of the random thugs, which nobody even recognized. I recognized his voice because I was like, that's the voice of Yakko Warner. Like,
yeah,
because those episodes aired next to each other.
Right,
in
right.
My market. And I was like, wait, I know that voice, you know?
Right.
And so it's like, that's one of the things that stick in my brain is like, that's the same voice guy that did just this random thug, which I know is probably a role he doesn't even remember doing because they were like, hey, read these lines. Here's a couple extra bucks or whatever, you know, however the business works. But so it was definitely, I am interested in that. Like, so you did grow, you were the one who had the famous dad in your circle of kids growing up.
Yeah.
And so how does that, like you said, it's not weighing you down. You don't carry that shame, or not shame, but that annoyance of having to be used just so somebody can get an autograph with you. But how, I can't imagine what that is like, someone using you to get to somebody else, because I'm so annoying. People don't even want to get to know me to get to know somebody else more famous. They're like, you know what? We'll just not meet that person. No. But it's like, I don't have that experience in my life. For you growing up, do you feel like that led to some of your feelings of feeling like being alone? And, you know, some of you say you didn't have a lot of friends. Do you think that hindered you from having a lot of friends as well growing up?
No, I think I was just, I think the two were probably unrelated. I mean, yeah, they're just, you know, kids, you know, can be mean. They're mean and awful sometimes and bullies. And I think I was an unpopular nerd as a kid. I'm a nerd now. But you know, being a nerd is much more in vogue these days than it was back in the,
I think about the amount of times I used to get in trouble 90s. In school.
Yeah.
Or being the only kid in my elementary school quoting Monty Python. Now everybody wants to quote Monty Python.
Exactly. So, you know.
Meanwhile, it led to my exile.
Yeah. Well, no, you know, back in elementary and middle school, being into video games was seen for nerds. But now everybody's into games. So,
yeah.
No, I think it was just kind of two unrelated things that happened at once. I was just kind of an unpopular nerd. And I also happened to have a famous dad who people wanted to get autographs from and would, you know, try to befriend me to do it. But, you know. I still get, not that I ever respond to them because I don't use Facebook. I haven't used Facebook in years and years, but I still get Facebook messages from my dad's fans who are like, oh my God, can you pass along a message to Rob for me? And I'm like, no, what? Get out of here. I've gotten some weird Facebook messages over the years from my dad's fans who just kind of take things a little bit too far. But, you know, where it used to bother me as a kid, you know, I grew out of that. I established my own niche. I established my own audience, my own space. And, you know, I am incredibly grateful to you to have been able to use everything he's taught me over the years about connecting with people and being gracious and humble to kind of reach out and connect with people in my own space and kind of build my own, following or audience with GVG and, you know, kind of connect with people in the same way that my dad does, make a difference in people's lives. Even if it's on a smaller scale, I don't reach nearly as many people as my dad does, but I still have been able to learn what I'd learned or use what I learned from him, watching him be an entertainer growing up and connecting with people in that way to establish my own space. And now I don't feel as though I'm competing with him or I'm being compared to him or existing in his shadow. It's more like, no, we both have our own individual platforms and we're both doing everything we can to use those platforms to better other people's lives. And I think that's something very special.
Working with both of you guys, both at the same time and individually, when putting together Game That Tune. There is a real genuine love between the two of you, which is so great to see that you guys, like, I've worked with other people who have family members. They don't always love each other. They get along, but they don't always love each other. And you and your father absolutely love each other. You love working with each other. You love supporting each other. And honestly, that was one of my favorite things about doing Game That Tune with you guys, you know, helping to produce and stream that, if I want to use the word produce as the guy who ran the Zoom.
I'd say so. I think that's fair.
Yeah, is that just working with two people that are genuinely nice people. I've worked with a lot of celebrities. Some are genuinely nice, and some are just nice, if you know what I mean. You know, they're nice because they have to be.
And I have no patience for that. And this is something I learned from my dad, too. Like, he and I have zero patience for egos. Like, it is such a privilege to be able to have people care about what you do. And it is such a damn privilege not only to have people care about what you do, but to be able to make a positive difference, to have people come up to you and say, man, you made my day so much better. You know, I'm working this crappy shift at my job that I hate, but man, listening to your show or listening to this video that you did, man, it put a smile on my face and it got me through that shift. Like, that is such a privilege to be able to play that role in even one person's life, let alone many people's however many people's.
Every episode, we had a young lady from England waking up at 2 a.m.
Right.
Just to watch you guys do your interviews. And almost every episode, she cried.
Yeah.
Because she was just so happy to be a part of the audience. It was there. You guys had a great dedicated following of people, and it shows because of the relationship between you and your dad. The reason I started giggling, because I was thinking about some of the people that, like, I'm going to name drop. I don't care. She's been on the podcast and she doesn't remember it. Laurie Kilmartin.
Okay.
Who is a comedian, writer for Conan. I did 30 Zoom shows with her.
Uh-huh.
Both as running the show and on the show with her.
Mm-hmm.
We've met in person multiple times. She's been on this podcast. I've interviewed her for a newspaper. She came back to Boston last year. I went up to her show and she goes, hi, I'm Laurie. Nice to meet you. I'm like, Laurie, we've met 30 times.
No. Yeah.
Every time. Like, it's a big joke between me and the guys that worked at Flappers that would be on shows with her. It's a big joke to us that she would just call all of us, hey, Flapper guy. I'm like, Laurie, you know my name.
Yeah.
And then, look, she is a sweetheart of a person. She is super nice. But she is also one of those people that just has zero remembrance of who I am. And it's a joke to me. And I make fun of it. I've done the same thing to her co-host, Jackie Cation, where it's like, Jackie Cation's been on my podcast and she doesn't remember who I am either. And we've done a bunch of Zoom shows together. And I'm not going to hold them to seeing that they're the worst people I've ever dealt with. They're not, by far. They're super nice and sweet. Like, we did, Jackie Cation and I did a festival together in Canada, in Toronto. And she came, did a show. She did a Q&A session with all the comedians. And then she went out and had dinner with us, and she just hangs like a normal person. She's cool. Mm-hmm. But also, at the same time, sometimes she just forgets who I am, you know?
Right.
But so there's celebrities I've worked with who are like, hey, look, it was really nice working with them. But you know, it's nice because, oh, I have to be nice to this person. You know, you can tell that they're, it's not even an ego thing. It's just like, I know that I'm not supposed to be an asshole. You know, like, you can tell they're like, they're forcing themselves to be nice. Whereas you guys don't force.
I don't get having to force yourself to be nice. Just being nice comes so easily to me. I don't, you know, just be a friendly person. I don't know. I don't understand why it's so hard for some people.
Sometimes I can get it. Like, I work in tourism now. I do Boston Duck Tours, where we drive people around the city of Boston and give them historic comedy tours.
Uh-huh.
And there's some people that are just like, some days where I'm like, I put on that smiley face and I tell my jokes and I be happy and I say, hey, I can't do this without your smiling face in the hallway. Take care. Uh-huh. And sometimes I want to just go, get off my bus, go away and leave me alone. I'm not even on anyone's level like this. So sometimes I can understand where it gets to
sure,
you.
Sure, sure.
But I know you guys, it'll never get to you guys because you guys are, you know, you grew up in a household of love, obviously.
Yeah. And you guys, I mean, I have a great relationship with my mom, too. I'm very lucky to have, you know.
And your mom's a sweetheart of a person, too, for the few times that I've met her through coming in on the Zooms. You know, so you guys have a wonderful household of it. So that's what I was saying. It's nice to see somebody working in LA in entertainment that have healthy relationships.
Yes. Well, I can definitely say I do have that. I'm very lucky on that front. I have amazing parents, an amazing wife. I'm very well loved. I'm very lucky on that front.
Awesome. All right, Ash, it's been great having you on the podcast. I'm glad we finally got to do this. This is literally in the making for years, where it's like, hey, let's do a podcast. All right, cool. All right, when are we going to do it? I don't know.
I know, we kept missing each other, yeah.
And then, like, thank God that I finally just went, I'm stopped doing it in person. I'm just doing it on remotely, because it is now that day easier to do now, whereas
it is.
Pre-pandemic, it was impossible. And right. People are more open to it. And look, I pride myself on saying that I'm a good interview. Like, the amount of people that complain about, Zoom interviews don't have the same interaction. They don't have the same personality. They don't have the same chemistry. I'm like, bullshit. I've been working in radio for years where I had to connect with people who all they had was listening somewhere else, you know, and we can make that connection there. We can make that connection over the internet. Anyone who's listened to my podcast, I dare you to tell me that any of my old podcasts were live in person or in any different way chemistry with my guests as the ones that I do over Zoom, Riverside, Squadcast, all those things. Any remote, I've done them over phones with people.
Right.
Right. And I go, sorry, it's not the basic quality. It's a phone call. Yeah. But you tell me that Lewis Black, who did a phone interview with me, is not as good of an interview as if him and I did it face to face. I dare anyone to try and find a way that. But anyway, sorry, I went on my own little rant at the end of my podcast.
All good.
Hey, look, the fact that I made it an hour and 26 minutes and didn't go on any rants for me and my podcast, that's an accomplishment for the longtime listener. So, Asher, it was great having you on. I'm glad we finally got to do this together. Take care of yourself, and I'll be talking to you soon.
All right, thanks so much.
Hi.